Australia remembers tape number 12. The date is the 30th of October 1995, and this interview is with Mr. Ted Allen of Cranbourne.
I was at Cranbourne when I enlisted. I was an engineer with the City of Shire of Cranbourne for many, many years, and until after the war. But I enlisted from Cranbourne, and I went into the Air Force, and went to Somers and Benalla, a place called Urumqinty in New South Wales, as a trainee pilot, and I did quite a bit of flying, but then I left the Air Force and went into the Army.
Why did you do that? Why did you change services?
Well, I was flying, and I'd had two flying accidents.
Right.
And they decided then that I would be better off as a navigator, and because of my engineering experience. So I refused that, and in the early part of the war, this goes back to 1941, you could change from a junior service to a senior service. And they were the Air Force Junior, then the Army, and then the Navy. This was in Hordeus. The Navy was the senior one, and the Army, then the Air Force was the most junior. So I could transfer. So I took a discharge and re-enlisted in the Army. That was December 1941. December 1941, yeah. And I went to Echuca, trained there at the Engineers Training Depot, and then I decided with several others that we'd volunteer for special services, and we went down to the Prom, Tidal River, and did our training there. In April 1942, they gathered us up and said, "You're off." We didn't get any disembarkation leave or anything like that, embarkation leave. We just got told to go. By the end of April, we were in New Guinea at Port Moresby. Then the unit were flown over to Wau. We were the first troops that were ever flown into a battle station. We were the pioneers of that. Unfortunately, I'd taken ill with dysentery, and I didn't fly over. I got the job of going down with a few others from the hospital. We had to walk over. We went down to a river called the Lakakamu. And we were taken up the Lakakamu River by little Lakatoys, two natives, to a canoe. They paddled us up the river, and then we walked over from a place called Bulldog into Wau. And during that time that our unit made simultaneous attacks on Lae and Salamoa for small groups. And naturally, the Japanese were looking for us, and I got into Wau just in time to be met by 9 aircraft belonging to the Japanese, giving us a good going over. But that was all in 42, and we served that area. I was in the Salamoa, what they call the Salamoa area, until Christmas 42, and that time we were very isolated. There was only a small group of us, and we had no proper food, or we had no medication. We got sick, we were just sick. And then we met the Japanese again at a place called Wandumi out of Wau, and that was the Battle of Wau. That was in February 1943. And then by the end of May, by the end of, would have been April, yeah, we were taken out and sent home because we were classed almost as B class because we were so ill with dysentery and malaria and beriberi. I was treated for beriberi. And
were you still doing special duties?
Oh yes, we were still doing that all the time.
What sort of work was it?
Well, we were in little camps. We might have I can refer to a place called Skindy Wai. It's a native name for skin of the tree. It was just a small camp built up, and the bark was used as a covering, and it was known as Skindy Wai. And well, we then did patrol work. We would go out in small groups, and we'd patrol right down into the Salamoa, sometimes on a fighting patrol, sometimes on a standing patrol. We'd stay in a little hidden place and we'd watch what the Japanese were doing, and we'd send the information back to our headquarters in Wau. And quite often that was transmitted across to Port Moresby, where they were able to be ready if necessary for air raids into Moresby, and of course we had no fighter support. They just couldn't get across. Well, they could get across, but they didn't have the ability to land. The small strip at Wau was too small for the fighter aircraft. It was only old biscuit bombers that were getting into the place. And so that meant that we were on the way home. In May, I got back in May 1943 and had a bit of leave, and we went up onto the Atherton Tablelands and we stayed there and trained, and we were getting very sick of ourselves up there because it was not very active. And in 1944 we got taken off again. We went with the quite a large convoy of troop carriers, and we went to a place called Muratai, a small island, and we went into the landing at Balikpapan, which is the southern part of Borneo. 9th Division landed at north of us, and we went into Balikpapan, and we were there until the end of the war. And then after the end of the war, we were taken, I went with several other fellows across into the Celebes, into Makassar, and our job was to just round up any loose Japanese, and there were plenty of them. Didn't even know the war was over. And also at that time the Red and White movement, that was Sukarno's uprising of the in the Indonesia. It was in, of course, Borneo was Dutch controlled, and we were more or less grabbed the Japanese and to tell all the natives around there, and the Raja of Watampone, and that's where we went in the Highlands, and telling him he better not play up or we'd blow his place up. And we made sure that none of our fellows got hurt, that our presence there meant that the uprising against the Dutch was a bit lengthened. That's about all that did happen, because it eventually took over, it took place anyway. And from there we came home. That was the end of the war.
How strong was the independence movement?
Big good.
How strong was the independence movement?
Wasn't very strong in the parts that we were in, but naturally in Java and those places it was. And even in Borneo, I understand, in Brunei and areas and so on, but Brunei's still British anyway. Excuse me, but no, we didn't have a lot of trouble in the place we were, and when we left, British troops took over. But in the end, the culmination of it was that Sukarno got the job, and he was top of the Indonesians, and, which included all the old Dutch areas and so on. Matter of fact, I've just recently got a medal from the Dutch group for anyone that served in their areas during that time.
And did you get much support from the Indonesian people?
No, none at all. It's, they were so sick of having the Japanese run around. See, the Japanese were in all those islands, and we just had to chase them out. But, so we beat them at Tarakan, and we beat them at Balik, and then the war ended when the atomic bomb landed. And it was unfortunate that a lot of the Japanese troops weren't informed that the war was over. And as a matter of fact, we took casualties after the war had ended. But it hadn't ended for us because they weren't aware that it had. So, it was just a period that but we accepted it because it was part of our job anyway.
And how was it different to New Guinea?
Quite a lot different, because for us in particular, in New Guinea, we were more or less in a complete jungle area. And I personally spent probably 6 months in that sort of environment, and I was amazed at when I got relieved at times and to go out into the Wau Valley, and we go out and this great expanse of kunai grass going over the mountains, and the sun shining on it, and you had to adjust your eyes because your eyes were adjusted to looking at close scrub or jungle, and then you see this great expanse and your eyes had to adjust there. An enormous experience to suddenly see this thing open up. But, in New Guinea it was always wet. By 4 o'clock you could say, righto, and then would come the fog and the rain and thunder. And mostly if you're on patrol work, well, you just got wet and you stayed wet. We walked in creeks even, rather than, so that we didn't leave any signs of our activities around the Japanese places. And the Japs knew we were there. They even put a sign up for us to tell us that if we surrendered, because they were going to come into the valley, they were going to take it, so we better surrender. And, we ignored that naturally. But that was the sort of situation in New Guinea. And for our point of view, we were not fed properly. They got ammunition to us, nothing else. We just grew beards because we didn't have shaving equipment. Half the time we didn't have proper clothing. We finished up with beriberi and malnutrition because we're eating bully beef and biscuits all the time. Very little else. We're not no green stuff. There was nothing in the jungle that you could eat. But some of our chaps were down at the Lae area, which was a more open area, and they did have things like bananas, pawpaws, native fruits that they could eat, and they didn't get the same problems medically as we got. And when we went on a patrol, well, All you had was your band-aids and your bandages and a few tablets. And you got malaria, well, you just got sick. And you couldn't stay behind because you just had to keep up. And malaria and dysentery in particular was pretty bad. those sort of conditions we didn't have in... another thing, just digressing for the moment, was the firepower. We didn't have the same sort of firepower that we had later on. We just had rifles, submachine guns, Thompsons, and later on Brens. We didn't have any mortars or anything like that, whereas the battalions had that stuff. But, we were a group of 270 that went into the WOW. And 80 or 100 got sent down to WOW and got sent down to Lae, whereas the others, some had to stay back in WOW and some had to go to little camps otherwise, because there's a certain tracks that we didn't know that the Japanese might come up, and eventually they did. And I was about 60 of us down in the Salamoa area, and that was the full strength of us. And some of the chaps that I went into New Guinea with, I didn't see again till we, this was in April 42, I didn't see again till April 43, so they were so far away from us.
So your base camp was about 80 people, was it?
No, the base camp at WOW was probably about 40.
Right.
And we... down to Skindiwai had and different camps like Waipali, Skindiwai, and we were at Mubo, where we were the Japs chased us out. They came up once and we gave them up that thrashing, and but they came up again with a lot more, and we was only 20 of us left in the place, so we had to leave. And but there were about 60 stationed around in the Salamoa area at that time.
And how big would your patrols be when you went out on patrol?
Sometimes the standing patrols were about four men. And the fighting patrol would be probably a dozen, no more, because we didn't have the strength.
And how far afield would you go with...
Well, we would go from, see, miles, we never knew what miles were in New Guinea. We went by days walking. I've got a film here, it's a tape of some of our activities in New Guinea. I'm going to show it at the RSL soon. And that gives a clear indication of what was meant. Were we going down to Mubo, for instance? It was a day's walk from WOW to our first stop, which was known as Ballam's Camp. Now, it was probably only about 6 or 7 miles, but you walked two level and the rest went up, you know, from 2,000 to 5,000 feet, and it was, by the time you got up there, you weren't going to walk anymore. And then from Ballam's, we'd make down to Wandoomy. That was a day's walk. Wandoomy to a place called House Banana. Again, we had the native situation where it was a little village and was built up with banana leaves, big banana leaves, but they were native banana leaves that didn't produce fruit. It was just a jungle banana. A day to Banana, House Banana, and a day down to Mubo. Well, from where we were really based on our patrols at Skindiwai, it was a day's walk down to House Banana and a day to Mubo, and that's where the Japanese were at that stage. Prior to that, we used to go down to Salamoa. It was another day's walk. So it would take us 3 days to get down to Salamoa, a place called Komiata, and we'd just watch the Japanese and send back information.
How close would you have to go?
Well, the raid into Salamaua, the fellas went, they did the patrols right into Salamaua, and we got as close as we could, or they did, into Muba. We did the same thing. We would go right opposite them. We knew the area, we knew the terrain, and we'd just set up a little bit of an observation point, and we'd be within a quarter of a mile of them, even less at times, we'd work, say, two or three fellas would go one side, two or three fellas the other, into the camp, and we'd organise our information, then the people back in where our senior officers were, they would decide that they'd put on a raid, which we did, and the raid, like me personally, I went on two raids, and both times the Japanese were just too strong for us, but we were able to let them know we were there, and the second one we had, by that time we were reinforced with the 2nd 7th Independent Company, and the 2nd 7th and ourselves, we put on a 3-day raid on that occasion, but we had to withdraw again. And it wasn't long after that that the Japanese decided that they better get rid of us. They attacked Wau, but fortunately by that time some of the 6th Division were getting in, and we had what they call the 78th Brigade were in Wau. So the Japanese only got to Wau, they got to right into the strip, but they had to give up because our firepower was just too much for them. And we had aircraft support too at that time, bow fighters and bombers, and which we didn't experience early. We didn't know anything about those. We didn't see them. Well, the difference was that at Balikpapan, we landed there, we had the support of the American 7th Fleet, which included a lot of Australian ships, destroyers, and Warramunga was one of them, and we had this awesome firepower that you thought, well, nobody could live in there, but they did, little hounds. And we landed under a lot of firepower for the ships, and a lot of air cover, but the conditions weren't as bad in Borneo. There was still a hot, humid, stinking place, but it was an oil spot. But the conditions were ever so much better because we had were part of a division, and we had their all their build up, their backup. We had plenty of food and plenty of ammunition.
Medical support.
Yes. Well, we were again unlucky that the day we landed at on Balik, we our objective was an airfield, and we got caught up onto a little flat area, and we took a lot of casualties, and our doctor he went out under fire to attend a wounded, and he got killed himself, so we didn't have a doctor. We had another one. So, that was the situation, but we did have our RAP, to back us up, good RAP fellas, that under those circumstances were probably as good as doctors anyway, because they knew what they had to do, and the thing was to get them onto stretchers and back to the shore, and back to the beach, and onto the onto the boat, what do you call them?
Medical. Hospital ships.
Hospital ship, yeah. Mm. Yes. Conditions in Borneo, as far as we were concerned, we were in a fight, but we didn't have to fight the elements as much as we did in New Guinea, which was, you know, pretty severe. In total, we probably had as many fellas go out sick as we did in casualty-wise. And we were all ill. I had dysentery and I'd had malaria on several occasions. I was treated for beriberi and it was a pretty hard sort of a caper.
Yeah. So when were you discharged?
I came home. The war ended August 45, didn't it? And I didn't get home till
6th of February.
February 1946, because I'd gone over to the Salabies, as I said, and we came home a bit later. But it was February, yeah. And I got a discharge, and I went straight back to engineering with the Shire after we got married.
Oh, you got a discharge about a month after you came home, wasn't it?
Oh, well.
Yeah. They didn't just discharge you and straight away. You had to wait. This is what a lot of people don't understand.
Yeah.
And where were you living, Mrs. Allen?
In Cranbourne, yeah.
So, you were born in Cranbourne.
Oh, well, what was Cranbourne like through the war?
Well, my husband worked in Cranbourne before the war.
I'm going to ask him about that in a minute, because that sounds very interesting.
He came when he was a young boy, man, adult, and he worked there, and then he went away to the war. But I had lived in Cranbourne all my life, apart from working, you know, away and coming back. My mother's family have lived in Cranbourne all far back, four or five generations.
Which area?
In Cranbourne, all around the area. Oh, yeah. The farm here, over here, the vegetable farm next door to us.
This was
part of it. The sand pit next door, the clay pit was part of it. And the abattoirs were part of it. And then across the road on the other side, you saw a house up on the hill on your coming up past it. Well, that was all Facey land too. This was all Facey land.
The old homestead where my wife was brought up is still
over here, the old farmhouse. Yeah.
What's it called?
Springmont. Mm. And we've called ours Springmont Pines. Because we've got a lot of pine trees and they do well here. It was like a village, you know. It wasn't a big place like it is now, and it was how many when you first came? 300 and something people.
No, in Cranbourne there were 150.
150 people. Mm. Yeah, there you are. Mm. Mm. And that was in the town area.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Then there was the surrounding district, and you knew everybody, and everybody knew you, and you just went to school there. I don't remember how many children went to the state school, which was up where the elderly citizens are now, and they pulled it down. And when my youngest daughter went to school and brought the school down beside, just down past the Church of England in Cranbourne, or just past
the Cranbourne Primary. Yeah. You've got so many of them.
But you didn't then. There was only the one school and that was it. But, you know, I can remember going, went to school there until I was 14, and you used to hang over the railing and watch the racehorses all come up. They used to come on the train to the Cranbourne station, and they had their race days, and then they would walk them from the station up to the race course. And it was great entertainment to stand on the wire on the fence and hang over and watch all the, you know, in the recess time and in the lunch hour. And then I suppose they walked them back and all got them on the train and took them home then, back to Caulfield and all those places where there were stables. There were more stables around that area, I would think, then than there were now. And Lawson Pool was the... you probably heard of Lawson Pool in your historical things. He did the pictures then, and you went up to the top of the Shire offices and the Shire Hall and you had pictures. And he showed a picture every Saturday night, And you sat on long seats and you watched the pictures. And
the Shah Hall.
In the Shah Hall. At the old Shah Hall. Mm. And...
which is now...
Is it cool?
Oh, it's on the corner there.
Yeah. And the offices for the Shah offices were just... You walked through the door and there was very few of it, wasn't there?
Well, when I started, I know the date. It was the 6th of May, 1936. I was 17 years of age and just never been away from home before. And
where'd you come from?
Ivanhoe. And I went to Northcote High School. I went to several schools in Melbourne prior to that, of course. And I got my leaving certificate at Northcote and got a job as a cadet engineer at Cranman. And I boarded at a house with no electric light and all the mod cons, so we just weren't there. But it was an experience for me.
What was the Shah? Hang on.